Good morning. Hezbollah struck back against Israel with one of its deadliest attacks of the past year. Four Israeli soldiers were killed at an army training base. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. State attorneys general believe TikTok executives knew about potential harms the app could cause and did nothing. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll go deeper into some of the claims and legal filings that NPR uncovered. Plus, Wisconsin's Senate race has tightened, giving Republicans a new path to the majority and how to stress less about political arguments among families and friends. It's Monday, October 14th. On this day in 1947, Air Force Captain Chuck Yeager became the first pilot to break the sound barrier, flying an experimental rocket plane over a dry lake in California. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Israel says four of its soldiers were killed and dozens of others were wounded after the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah struck an army training base. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports it was one of the deadliest attacks on Israel in the past year.
Hezbollah in Lebanon said it had targeted the base in the central Israeli city of Binyamina in retaliation for Israeli strikes in Beirut last week that killed 22 people. Israeli Army Radio reports the drone hit the roof of a dining hall full of soldiers. The military says more than 50 soldiers were wounded, seven of them seriously. Israel is investigating why the drone was not intercepted by air defense systems. The army says Hezbollah has fired about 13,000 rockets, missiles, and drones since it began firing on Israel last year. Israel's offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon continues. Lebanese health officials say at least 51 people were killed in Israeli strikes Sunday. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Vice President Kamala Harris spent the weekend on the campaign trail with less than a month before the November election. NPR's Elena Moore reports Harris made a stop in Greenville, North Carolina on Sunday, where polls show a tight race in the state.
Speaking to a packed arena at East Carolina University, Harris spent much of her speech railing against former President Donald Trump, including targeting his fitness for office. Just a day after Harris disclosed a medical report that said she is in excellent health, she made jabs at Trump for not releasing similar information and questioned his team's strategy.
Are they afraid that people will see that he is too weak and unstable?
On Saturday, a spokesman for the Trump campaign defended the former president's ability to serve and pointed to his previous medical updates. Elena Moore, NPR News, Greenville, North Carolina.
Authorities arrested a man near the site of former President Donald Trump's rally in Coachella, California on Saturday. Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco says deputies stopped a black SUV at a security checkpoint near the event.
The license plate was what we in law enforcement would recognize as one that is homemade and indicative of a group of individuals that claim to be sovereign citizens. And the deputy assumes that he was part of that identifying group.
Police say the man had a shotgun, a loaded handgun, and ammunition in his vehicle. Authorities also uncovered several passports and multiple driver's licenses. The U.S. Secret Service says the former president was not in any danger, adding that the incident did not impact security operations. This is NPR. Cleanup operations continue across central Florida nearly a week after Hurricane Milton made landfall. More than 400,000 customers remain without power. Officials are also reporting long lines at gas stations amid fuel shortages. Governor Ron DeSantis says the state has opened several fuel distribution sites, and residents can get 10 gallons of gas each free of charge. NASA is preparing to launch a mission to Waterworld, a moon of Jupiter that appears to have a subsurface ocean. If all goes planned, the spacecraft will take off on a SpaceX rocket shortly after 12 p.m. Eastern time today. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports the spacecraft will spend more than 5 years traveling to the planet.
Jupiter's got a bunch of moons, but this probe will be focused on Europa, an ice-covered world about the size of Earth's moon. Scientists think that miles below Europa's icy crust, it has lots of liquid water, perhaps twice as much water as there is in all of Earth's oceans. This spacecraft won't land on Europa. Instead, it will fly by dozens of times, getting as close as about 16 miles above the ice. The probe has a suite of science instruments, including ice-penetrating radar and high-resolution cameras, to see if conditions on this moon could be capable of supporting life. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds. While you're
turning. 2:29 a.m., August 27, 1979, Warren, Minnesota. Deputy Officer Val Johnson was on patrol along State Highway 220 when he spotted a light. It was an odd light. He went to investigate, and the light came at him. Sometime later, Deputy Johnson roused himself to find his police cruiser in a ditch. He also had burns around his eyes. Johnson called dispatch. According to Jerome Clark's UFO Encyclopedia, Val Johnson had experienced a UFO encounter. The Minnesota deputy was suddenly national news. But when interviewed in 2015, Val Johnson, then 71 and living in Wisconsin, couldn't say if he'd encountered a UFO or not. It was just a light. Still, diehard UFO enthusiasts make the pilgrimage to the Marshall County Historical Society to see Val Johnson's squad car, still bearing the damages, sustained that August night.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, what do we learn from redacted documents that NPR revealed about TikTok?
But first, a drone attack launched by Hezbollah on an Israeli army training base killed 4 Israeli soldiers and injured several more.
It's one of the more serious acts of retaliation after Israel's attacks on the armed group, which is based in Lebanon. Now, the Pentagon says it's sending an advanced anti-missile system to Israel, along with about 100 U.S. troops to operate it, all to help bolster the country's defenses against Iran.
NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has been following these developments, and she's with us now from Tel Aviv. Good morning, Jackie.
Morning, Michelle.
First of all, just tell us what we know about this drone attack.
Well, as you said, it was against an army base in a place called Binyamina in central Israel, about 40 miles from the Lebanon border. And it's one of the deadliest Hezbollah attacks in this past year. Israel's military said the drone hit the roof of a dining hall full of soldiers, and that, in fact, there were 2 drones launched. One was shot down, but this one hit the base. And the military is looking into why the drone wasn't intercepted and why no warning sirens were activated, as is usually the case. Hezbollah said the attack was in response to Israeli strikes in Beirut last week, which killed more than 20 people. And, you know, Israel's been pushing deeper into southern Lebanon and Beirut, killing militants and destroying their arsenal. But, you know, as this attack shows, Iranian-backed Hezbollah still has firepower to reach Israel. And, Michelle, of course, the war in Gaza continues. And just this morning, an Israeli strike targeted a large hospital there, killing 4 people, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. And then there was another deadly Israeli strike that hit a Gaza school.
So the Pentagon announced Sunday that it is sending a missile defense system to Israel to help with its defense. What can you tell us about this?
It's an advanced mobile defense system called Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Battery. It's usually referred to simply as THAAD, and it's designed to shoot down ballistic missiles. As you mentioned earlier, it'll be operated by U.S. troops, and this is the first time since the war in Gaza started just over a year ago that the U.S. has sent a significant number of troops to Israel, which means greater involvement by the U.S. in defending Israel, but it also means there are concerns about the conflict broadening throughout this region.
And as this fighting between Israel and Hezbollah intensifies, there are also UN peacekeepers getting caught up in the conflict. At least four soldiers have been wounded in the past few days in Lebanon. Has the UN said anything about that?
Yeah, there's this growing rift between Israel and the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. It's known as UNIFIL, and it's an international force that's been there since 1978, and it helps secure the Lebanon-Israel border. But yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a direct appeal to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to evacuate UNIFIL troops from southern Lebanon, claiming that Hezbollah is using peacekeepers as human shields. Guterres doesn't have the authority to do that, by the way. But later in the day, UNIFIL said two Israeli tanks forcibly entered one of its posts and some shells were exploded and released smoke that sickened some peacekeepers. Israeli military disputes that version of events, saying Hezbollah fired anti-tank missiles and, you know, the Israeli tanks were just trying to get their troops out of the area. It's hard to say how this situation is going to, you know, between UNIFIL and Israel is going to play out as Israel continues its increasingly aggressive campaign into Lebanon, you know, to root out Hezbollah militants.
That is NPR's Jackie Northam. Jackie, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Next, we try to make sense of secret information revealed on NPR. The information comes from a lawsuit against TikTok. State attorneys general accused the social media site, in essence, of getting kids addicted to the platform. Redacted material revealed last week by NPR and Kentucky Public Radio suggests that company executives knew about the app's potential risks for teenagers and did nothing. Linda Charmeriman is a senior research scientist at the Wellesley Centers for Women, and she is studying this. She's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
What did you learn when you read these documents?
Well, we all intuitively know that when you get on certain social media platforms that it can be hard to pull yourself away, whether it's because you're avoiding doing something else or that the content can be entertaining. However, there isn't enough information from the redacted internal research from TikTok to conclude what sort of harms to young people that they knew about, except for the screen time that they have been reported on, and whether the 260 videos need to be watched in succession or if it's over a long period of time.
That's interesting. We should explain what you're saying. There's a description in here of kids getting effectively addicted, which is a term we're going to discuss, addicted in 35 minutes, which can be a couple hundred videos given how short many of them are. That's what you're referring to.
Yes, the calculation that the Attorney General's made in as little as 35 minutes uses the most extreme estimate of a TikTok video being as short as 8 seconds in length, when the average TikTok video in 2024 is actually 42.7 seconds, which amounts to 3 hours or more of viewing time. But if you take the other extreme, the example of the longest types of TikTok videos, it could be as long as 15 minutes, and it would take more than 65 hours to become quote-unquote addicted.
Ah, so you're telling me that it's the number of videos that you see that makes this hazardous, and it could take you a while to get there. Nevertheless, we have this idea of people being addicted, and we're using that term, but is that the right term? Is this actually what happens to teenagers when they watch too much social media?
Well, it really depends on why they are on it in the first place and the kind of content that they're exposing themselves to. You know, technically, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, has not officially included addiction disorders such as, you know, that the ones that we colloquially refer to as internet addictions or social media addictions, because it's really hard to figure out what's pathological and what's non-pathological, you know, being hooked on, you know, these platforms. So I would say that it's a slippery slope when people start using those
terms. Thank you for that. So it's a giant time suck, and people really can have trouble pulling themselves away in a way that makes them feel helpless. I mean, that's all true, right?
Mm-hmm. It is. It's more like a repetitive behavior that's kind of compulsive, or sometimes it's fueled by anxiety and that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask about safety features here. Some of the safety features in the documents are described as being PR rather than substantive, but TikTok, in its response to NPR's reporting, said we voluntarily launched safety features, parental controls, increased privacy for minors under 16, that sort of thing. Does this stuff work? Can you do this? Can you make it safer?
I would say that most companies, you know, want to make sure that, you know, they want repeated customers, right? But they also want to make the product, you know, safe so that there'll be some trust in the product, you know, from the public side. And so these types of measures to reduce time spent on the platform are still focused on screen time in general, which is not the entire, you know, story. You know, it's about why are people on this site? Are they looking up lots of recipes because they're trying to get ready for an important event, you know, and that's why they're on it, you know, for over a couple hours, you know? Or are they on it because they can't take themselves away, and they're getting themselves away from their important, you know, life responsibilities, like sleeping enough and eating at meals and going to work, going to school, doing their homework, you know. So that's when it's more pathological, when, yes.
Right. It's all about the context. Linda Charmaraman of the Youth Media and Wellbeing Research Lab at the Wellesley Centers for Women. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Steve, you know, it's even quieter down here at the studio than usual because it's Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. You know, President Biden issued a proclamation a few years ago that this day can be celebrated as both. Mm-hmm. But did you know that for our northern neighbors, it is Thanksgiving?
I have heard that, and I'm sure that our Canadian colleagues would take any chance to make sure that we know it. They celebrate before America celebrates its Thanksgiving, because we're told of the long northern winter, meaning you have an earlier harvest season.
But I'm seeing that, like other holidays, the meaning has changed over time.
Historically, it was a big religious occasion.
A religious occasion, says Peter Stevens, a Canadian historian at Humber College in Toronto.
Everyone would go to church and hear these sermons that were not your typical church sermon, but were sort of half religion and half sort of nation building.
Images of the harvest were historically used as symbols of national abundance, but it won't surprise you to know that the Indigenous people whose lands were taken were not included in these Canadian sermons.
The stories are just as murky here in Canada as they are in the United States in terms of how Thanksgiving began between settlers and Indigenous peoples.
Kevin White is an Indigenous scholar at the University of Toronto and a member of the Mohawk Nation, and he says Indigenous people taught settlers how to hunt, how to fish, how to farm.
The newcomers were not prepared for this new world, and Indigenous people helped them and showed them, you know, these are safe to eat, these aren't safe to eat. There's a lot of layering to this.
White says Indigenous communities across North America have a tradition of giving thanks that goes back to before contact with settlers.
For example, we as Mohawks and Senecas and Haudenosaunee or Iroquois people have a Thanksgiving address that we basically enact daily that acknowledges all of the natural world and its bounty that provides for our existence in a what we call a good mind or a contented mind.
Today, Canadians as a nation have different Thanksgiving traditions than in the U.S. Instead of watching American football, Peter Stevens says Canadians like to contemplate fall foliage.
You drive and you see the fall leaves, and maybe you stop in at a winery, and then you pop in and get a flavor for the local pastries and some butter tarts and things like that.
Canadians apparently love butter pies. Think pecan pie minus the pecans, or Nanaimo bars.
So you've got sort of a base that's got some chocolate and coconut in it, and then the middle layer is this kind of creamy yellow color that's quite sweet. And then there's sort of a layer of chocolate on top of that.
I did not see the coconut coming, Michelle, but part of the classic Thanksgiving turkey dinner that Canadians do enjoy. It is part of that, along with mashed potatoes and gravy and beans.
Well, there's always room for more chocolate, right? always room for more chocolate.
I like the description of being half religious, half nation building. In America, of course, it's half religious, half nation building, half football, half commercials. Anyway. This is NPR News.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many landowners in rural parts of the southeastern U.S. have farmed on their land for decades. But as they get older and worry about their family's future, some feel a financial need to sell some of their land, potentially to someone who will develop it. Now the American Forest Foundation is giving some farmers an alternative, growing trees.
They're used to tending the land, and trees can be considered a crop.
Amy Tomcho is with the foundation's Field to Forest program. It pays landowners in Georgia to convert at least 40 acres to forest planted with loblolly pine, a tree native to the southeast. As these trees grow, they absorb planet-warming carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Landowners commit to growing trees for at least 30 years. They're allowed to thin a limited amount, which can provide additional revenue if the wood is sold. If they harvest more, the trees must be replanted. Tomcho says the program helps protect the climate and preserve rural America.
If you ask these landowners what their goal is, it really centers around keeping that land open, continuing their legacy as farmers and foresters.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. With only weeks until a presidential election, it can be hard to talk politics, even sometimes with people we love. Political polarization can be tough on our relationships, and it can actually hurt our health. So if you want to stress less over the political divide, NPR's Allison Aubrey is here to help. So Allison, when I talk to my family about politics, it's not even about picking sides. Mm. It's about facts, just arguing about over what is true and what is not. The arguments get bitter. We love each other. How is this impacting my health?
Absolutely. I mean, fighting with your family or feeling divided with your neighbors can increase feelings of anxiety. And more than that, one of the most interesting studies shows that the more distant a person feels from the political norm in their state, the more likely they are to report feeling sick. So people with liberal views who live in a conservative area or Republicans living in a blue state who feel isolated report more sickness.
Like physically more sick? I mean, really?
Yes, I spoke to Tim Frazier at Cornell University. He's behind the study. He and his collaborators found people who felt politically isolated reported feeling unwell about 2 more days per month.
Because if you feel politically isolated, you're one step less likely to be checking in with your neighbors, right? We think it's probably a strong association with your social capital, those social ties that connect you.
So political isolation may translate into less connection and perhaps less social support. And this holds up across the political spectrum, Republican or Democrat.
So considering how heated this election has been, I mean, is it even possible to bring people together?
Well, there are lots of people trying to bridge the divide. One group we talked to is Braver Angels. They're a national organization, and we caught up with them at a county fair in Oregon, where they invited people to talk about issues that really divide Americans. So let me set the scene. They set up their booth kind of like a carnival game, and someone is about to spin the wheel, but instead of a lucky number, they're going to land on an issue. Let's take a listen.
All righty. Abortion, gun control.
It was a Saturday night, and Robin Grover stepped up to give it a try.
We'll spin it.
Yay. Okay, gun control.
So what happens next is a dialogue, and it's led by these two Braver Angels volunteers, one who leans Democrat.
I'm Sue Staley.
And one from the other side.
I'm Elizabeth Christensen. I'm the red co-chair, and that means that I would probably vote Republican, usually do.
So red and blue, same booth.
That's right. And they both got involved for similar reasons. Christensen was having a really hard time with her family after the 2020 election.
I was shocked to learn that a sister and my father voted differently than me. And it shook me to my core.
And Sue Staley got into it over politics with her son.
We kind of went on opposite sides of all the issues for a while, and he was quite angry with me.
She says politics has become so toxic.
What drove me to Braver Angels was my absolute walking away from the politics of ridicule.
You know, both of them say doing anything to help bridge the divide just feels good. So on this night at the fair, they really tried to help Robin think through gun control.
If you had to put yourself on the continuum here, where would you put yourself?
So Robin is from rural Oregon, and she's asked what's more important, protecting public safety or defending the right to protect yourself.
I feel like they're both so important, okay, right? That we're able to protect mm-hmm. ourselves, but obviously, like, public safety is, you know, I think every bit as important as our personal safety. So I guess I would have to go in the middle.
Go in the middle, yeah. Right.
So talking about these issues this way, these Braver Angels volunteers find a lot of people, red or blue, tend to be in the middle, just like Robin. They can see both sides.
Yeah, I've known that. I mean, there's no way that's not true. I mean, right? And I guess that's the whole point of this.
That's right. And some scholars who study the political divide see this. I spoke to Tanya Israel. She's a psychologist at UC Santa Barbara and the author of Facing the Fracture.
We are absolutely not as divided as we think we are. There's so much research over decades that shows that our perceptions of how polarized we are, of what the distance is between our views, are really overblown. That we think that Democrats and Republicans are much farther apart on the issues than they actually are.
Okay, but here's the thing, Allison. So anyone that has a screen in front of them, social media, television, watching political ads, I mean, you would think that if that's all they saw, they would think, my God, that's no way that's possible. Everyone's divided as can be.
Exactly. That's why Tanya Israel recommends limiting media and social media that reinforces this one point of view or kind of ups that us versus them narrative. And remember, some of the most vitriolic comments come from people who are deliberately trying to throw gas on the fire. So the value of the Braver Angels model is that people interact face to face. It's easier to see the humanity in others this way.
The more we can interact with actual human beings and the complexity of ideas and experiences that we all have, the better understanding we'll have of how truly complex and thoughtful people are.
So I want to leave you with something to try,
Okay, if it's an exercise, I'm ready. I'm stretched. I'm loose. I'm ready to go.
All right. So it's an exercise Braver Angels calls depolarizing within. So it's really easy to overlook how much judgment we all carry around personally. So to assess this, you ask yourself this question. How often do you bond or kind of joke with friends about the quote unquote crazies on the other political side? You know, for those who lean blue, words like anti-immigrant or Bible thumper are often used. People who lean red tend to label the other side as elitist or unpatriotic. But these labels can be snarky, right? They can raise the temperature, especially when they don't fully reflect a person's view. So if we stop using labels, it may open the door to connections with people on the other side.
That's NPR's Allison Aubrey. And if you want to join our newsletter series on de-stressing, go to npr.org/stressless. Thank you very much, Allison.
Thanks, Great to be here.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
Al Pacino never wanted to be a movie star. He just wanted to act.
I thought, this is it. I have this. It doesn't matter what happens. If I become famous, if I eat, I don't eat. If I make money, I don't make money.
I'm Ari Shapiro. My conversation with Pacino about his life and his memoir on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock today on KAXE. Good morning. It is 5:29. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few minutes, our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. KAXE is introducing a new occasional call-in program on Fridays at noon. Dialed In will feature listener call-in, fact checks, local government and election information, and analysis with our news team. Join host Heidi Holton starting this Friday, October 18th, plus October 25th and November 1st at noon for Dialed In on KAXE. Our weather for today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, winds from the north around 5 to 10. For tonight, mostly clear, lows in the upper 20s, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, with highs in the low 50s. Many communities are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day today. There's an event in Grand Rapids from 1 to 5 on the Central School lawn and at the Ginnewin Creative Space across the street, with a round dance, artist vendors, art activities, and more. Also, at the Crow Wing County Courthouse in Brainerd today from 4 to 7, you can learn why history and story matter with a program at 4:30. That'll feature the Mille Lacs Color Guard and a jingle dress presentation. Refreshments will be served. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. There are meetups for those new to the Iron Range the third Tuesday of every month at the Hibbing Public Library and the third Thursday at the Virginia Public Library. Both of those will be happening this week. Meetings are from 4:30 to 6 at both locations. You can RSVP at helloironrange.com. Nameless Coalition for the Homeless has an autumn open house tomorrow from 11 to 2 at their newly renovated day center on 15th Street in Bemidji. It's time for our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, October 14th, 2014, I discover a large paper wasp's nest, and while investigating it, a paper wasp emerges. This is unusual because by now, most paper wasps have perished, but warm weather and light frosts have allowed this one big bald-faced wasp to survive and not very menacingly fly about. It didn't seem to be the sort of action of an aggressive wasp. It was cool enough where the wasp was having trouble just making flight plans, and I didn't fear for my life in this case. I didn't think that this wasp was going to sting me. But it is revelatory, as the leaves begin to fall this time of the year, to see where these wasps have made their homes. And oftentimes, it's within a few feet of where you've been walking all summer and haven't even noticed.
Why some countries are poor and others prosper. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Both Vice President Harris and former President Donald Trump are focused on Wisconsin. That's a swing state where Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin is locked in a tight race for re-election that could determine whether Democrats maintain their majority in the Senate.
Baldwin says she has won in the past thanks in part to what she calls Trump Tammy voters who voted for the Republican presidential candidate but also for her.
They see that I've showed up, I've listened, that I've taken their fight to Washington, and I produce results.
The question is whether she can rely on them in 2024.
Joining us now to talk about these dynamics is Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk. Anya, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
So let me set the table here. Baldwin won her last race in 2018 by 11 points, and things look very different this time around. Why so different?
Yeah, that outcome was really an unheard of landslide by Wisconsin standards. Part of the change since then just has to do with sort of nitty-gritty politics. So previous Republican challengers had nasty primary fights. This time around, her opponent, Eric Hovde, avoided that. And so he started with a pretty clean slate. But then part of it is also just the realities of partisan politics. Those have gotten more entrenched everywhere in the country. And so in Wisconsin, which is about as 50-50 as it gets, you're seeing people just go into their camps. Baldwin has always run as a different kind of Democrat, really a workhorse who just knows Wisconsin. And she's done really well with independents and even in counties that also support Trump as a result. But this time around, Hovde is closely aligned with Trump. And that plus that ever-growing polarization means Baldwin is expecting many fewer Trump Tammy voters.
Can you just tell us a bit more about those Trump Baldwin counties? What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I spent a day out on the trail with Baldwin, including a stop in Richland County, which is an example of this. It's a rural county that went for Trump in his past two elections and for Baldwin in her last two elections. Other Democrats, including Kamala Harris, are focused just on losing those kinds of rural areas by less. But Baldwin has this record she can point to that's really focused on things like manufacturing and the dairy industry, and that makes her stand out there. I think we're seeing some of that shared strategy across the blue wall states of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, not writing off those areas. And when I was out there, so was Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. I asked him what he made of all the pro-Trump yard signs nearby.
Senator Baldwin and I show up in communities like this, and we treat voters with respect, no matter what signs might be on a neighbor's lawn or what past election results have shown.
Okay, finally, Anya, tell us the kinds of messages you're seeing in the final few weeks of this campaign.
Yeah, the Baldwin campaign has really sought to paint Hovde as a wealthy outsider. He's from Wisconsin, but he also has a home in California, and he manages a bank that's based in Utah, so they're really focused on drawing that contrast. And then Hovde is trying to tie Baldwin to the Biden White House and its economic policies. Recently, too, we've been seeing a lot more ads that are kind of based in the culture wars, so attacking her approach to transgender issues, for example. And both parties are also just focused on the national stakes of this election and, of course, control of Congress.
That is Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk. Anya, thank you.
Thank you.
The Lebanese armed group Hezbollah claimed responsibility for an attack on Israel. A drone strike killed four Israeli soldiers and wounded many others at a military training facility. The big question in the Middle East is what Israel does next. Days ago, Iran launched a major missile attack at Israeli targets, saying it was retaliating for a variety of Israeli actions. Israel intercepted many of those missiles and then said Iran will pay. Okay? How? Daniel Byman joins us next. He researches terrorism and counterterrorism at Georgetown University. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, just first, does Israel have to respond to Iran, given that it blocked the attack? It was mostly a failure.
So Israel would say it has to respond for several reasons. First, some of the missiles did get through. Now, this, you know, thank goodness for Israel, it didn't cause any significant damage, but they did get through.
Okay.
And this is the second attack. So Israel feels that the first time it went gentle in its response and that didn't work. So this time it's going to need to do a much stronger response.
Okay. What are the options that the Israeli leaders can face?
So there are probably four categories to think about. The first is, as Israel did in Lebanon and Gaza, killing senior Iranian leaders. Another is going after Iran's energy infrastructure. Another is going after the nuclear infrastructure. And the last is targeting various missile and other military sites. And of course, it could be some combination.
I am listening to those and trying to think of what would or would not cause a wider Mideast war. I'm also thinking of what Israel's closest ally has been saying. President Biden, I understand, has said publicly he doesn't want Israel attacking Iranian nuclear facilities.
And the United States has also discouraged attacks on the energy infrastructure. Israel, of course, has at times ignored what President Biden wants, but a lot's also going to depend not just on what Israel strikes, but how extensively. Is there a lot of damage? Are there a lot of casualties? Does it, from an Iranian point of view, force Iran to escalate itself?
I can see the dangers from the oil infrastructure, the energy infrastructure. You immediately jolt the oil markets, you harm the economies of countries around the world, and you have this Iranian threat to retaliate by attacking Saudi or other oil facilities if their oil facilities are attacked. But then you named that other option, attacking essentially Iranian military targets like their missile infrastructure. Is that something that, can the missiles be found? Is this something Israel probably can do?
So Iran's missile infrastructure is pretty big. There are lots of systems and a lot of it scattered, but Israel can certainly hit some of it and can weaken the capacity, go after stockpiles. And Israel has shown itself to have excellent intelligence, not only in Lebanon, but also in Iran. So there's certainly likely to be some capability, but it's not going to be comprehensive.
Now, when we started going through the Israeli options here, we noted from the Israeli point of view, they feel that they need to establish deterrence. They need to make sure that Iran pays a price so it doesn't attack Israel in the same way again. I guess that's a strategic goal. But in a larger sense, do you see a strategic way out of this war for Israel right now?
So Israel has different goals depending on where you look. But a lot of it's going to depend on having some sort of ceasefire and settlement in Gaza. And in my view, that's been Israel's biggest failure, is that it hasn't planned for something to replace Hamas. And a lot spirals from there. In Lebanon and Yemen, groups have said they'll keep fighting as long as Hamas is fighting. Iran, of course, is backing Hamas. So to me, you got to start in Gaza.
You say got to start in Gaza. If your Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is just fighting on and on, an option?
I would love to tell you no, but 6 months ago I would have said that Israel at some point has to stop, and here we are over a year. So I think continued fighting of some sort seems to be likely. Again, there's no plan for some replacement government in Gaza, but the pace is getting more and more intense, and I don't think Israel can sustain that indefinitely.
Daniel Byman is Director of Security Studies at Georgetown University. He's also at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The first things I did when I moved to northern Minnesota was find the local public radio station. I will never forget how I came to understand northern Minnesota through the voices I heard on KAXE and KBXE.
Awesome.
I have never seen this many books.
My extremely Norwegian grandfather, Marv Johnson's sister, Irene, married Leo Fraboni, the extremely Italian founder of the Fraboni Sausage Company in Hibbing. That meant that once a month, for most of my childhood, an authentic Italian porchetta would fall off the truck.
Jazz, but it had this European flavor, which really reminded me of the heritage on my dad's side, which is Croatian. So when I heard Django,
the leaves on the basswood are yellow, but the willow and quaking aspen are still green.
My name is Sonia Merrill. If you appreciate and love the stories of the people in our community just as I do, become a member. Go to kaxe.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. If you have kids in school, you know how important it is to check in with their teachers from time to time. But what if you don't speak the same language or you don't understand things like how to interpret the report card? We're going to hear about a school in Utah where Hispanics represent a quarter of that state's recent growth that's making a real effort to reach out to Spanish-speaking parents and finding a receptive audience. Martha Harris with member station KUER reports.
Timpanogos Middle School parents trickle into the school's library one evening for a monthly meeting. They find their seats and Principal Jim Judd updates them.
So today was the last day for kids to get all their work turned in.
The school's Yuri Jensen is also there. Jensen translates what the principal says into Spanish, then conducts the rest of the meeting entirely in Spanish. She's the school's liaison for Spanish-speaking families. The group learns about what's going on at school, in the community, and how parents can help their kids. Alfonso Flores grew up in Mexico, but now has lived in Utah for a couple of decades. When he first moved here, it was hard to know what was going on at his kids' school.
Like the grade system, like the procedures of how to check on the classes, attendance, and all these other things that they're very foreign to me because I grew up in a different environment.
Especially with his oldest son, Flores says he didn't understand his report cards.
But I never look into, are they really good or just passing or can you improve here or there? It was more like, trust them and say, whatever they say, it's okay.
But when his youngest daughter started going to Timpanogos Middle, he joined Padres y Madres Líderes, or Latino parent leaders. Flores says he's now less intimidated by the school system, teachers, and the principal. He thinks this has helped his kids because it makes them more accountable.
And sometimes even make it more fun because now they know that, oh, my dad understands what's happening, and so we can work together.
Wasatch County's Hispanic population grew by almost 60% over a decade.
As more people come, having that knowledge and having more training for those parents, it will just be beneficial for all the kids.
When Spanish-speaking liaison Jensen was hired, she told the principal that instead of just focusing on student behavior, the school needed to get parents involved. She knows what it's like for the parents she works with. She also grew up in Mexico.
And just letting them know, hey, I was one of them. I didn't speak English, and now I am, so you guys can do it too.
Principal Judd told me he used to never hear from Latino parents. Now the number of Spanish-speaking parent volunteers is bigger than the English-speaking group. Judd showed off data on how test scores have improved over the past couple of years and thanked the parents.
Because I know that a lot of the reason for our kids doing better in this school is because of you guys. Because you're showing your kids that you're involved, you're invested, you care, that they do well.
Jensen says the parents learn how to help their own children, but they also volunteer and are able to help others.
The impact that we have had in the last couple years has been tremendous because these amazing parents that we have.
The group has come up with initiatives to encourage kids to turn in their work. Volunteer parents can be seen walking through the halls during the school day, making sure kids get to class. Jensen says the Latino community was ready to give back. They just needed to feel welcomed. For NPR News, I'm Martha Harris in Wasatch County, Utah.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From conversations about local government or sports or breakfast or even hunting, when you tune in to KAXE, you feel like you're home.
I was surprised even when I saw the numbers. I mean, they had, just to give you an example, first weekend, they had nearly 1,200 bears registered. The most they've seen in a single day going back 20 years was 790.
Because I cook the bacon first, and then I use the bacon grease to saute the onions, and then I make the omelet.
Okay, the Minnesota Chippewa tribe consists of the six bands. There's White Earth, Leech Lake, Boys Fort, Grand Portage, Fond du Lac, and Mille Lacs.
Support conversations about where we live, this place we call home. Come home to KAXE with your membership to keep these conversations going. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for your support.
There's word in the last hour that two MIT economists and one from the University of Chicago have won the Nobel Prize for Economics.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to protect users needing access to secure logins for personal or work accounts from any device anywhere. Bitwarden.com. And by the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations that inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org.
We'll get back to the Nobel Prize in a minute, but in the run-up to the election, we're looking at political polarization in America at the company level. Today, one of a series of approaches to turn down the temperature among people supporting Trump or Harris in the workplace. David Livermore is founder of the Cultural Intelligence Center and professor at the Questrom School of Business at Boston University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, David.
What's your definition of cultural intelligence, and how could it help bridge divides in a divided community, even a divided workplace?
So cultural intelligence is quite simply the capability to relate and work effectively with people who are different than you. And traditionally, we've looked at that in terms of differences across international domains and also within the domestic region across different ethnicities or generations. But increasingly, cultural intelligence also predicts how well somebody can work across ideological divides or political divides that seem to be showing up everywhere, even in the workplace.
And what does your research show? That the model that you developed to talk about international divides, can it help inform what we're seeing sometimes just at the office?
Yeah, and if I'm honest, sometimes it's actually easier to do it across the international divides. Oh, you know, I can be forgiving that they have a very different perspective. One of the things that we found is just starting with a simple question to somebody like, hey, would you be open to considering a different perspective on that? And that starts to prime people for, well, okay, I'm open to at least hearing your different perspective and then sort of picking it up from there.
I mean, some people will already be concerned because if you're trying to persuade a coworker, that's a tall order. We need to start with at least hearing the person out who you might object to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would caution any of us against thinking we're going to proselytize others to see our point of view. An exercise we've sometimes tested out in the research is Can you describe the opposing viewpoints, perspective, without using pejorative terms? And to catch each other back and forth, like, wait, no, that's not exactly what I'm saying, rather than trying to convince one another that we need to believe the same thing in order to find a way to coexist together in the workplace.
But you're saying that could go a long way?
Yeah, at least in the work setting, when you're suddenly talking about friendships, there's a whole different level of issues there. But the workplace, it's, hey, we're here because we're trying to get a job done. And one of the things that we find in the research that's key is if this is going to go a long way, it really requires a leader with the cultural intelligence to know how to navigate this.
David Livermore, founder of the Cultural Intelligence Center and research professor at Questrom School of Business at Boston University, among his books, Leading with Cultural Intelligence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Political polarization at the company level, our election season project, is called Office Politics. Lots of angles here. Our pieces are accumulating at Marketplace Online. Markets, S&P and NASDAQ futures are up between 2 and 3/10%, but Dow futures are down slightly, 0.1%. Over the weekend, China's finance minister laid out spending plans, but left many investors hanging on the scale and scope of strategies to boost China's weak economy. The Shanghai Composite Index did go up 2%, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng edged lower.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by C3 Generative AI, verified traceable answers, secure, hallucination-free, LLM-agnostic, IP liability-free, C3.ai. This is Enterprise AI. And by Rubrik. When cyber attacks put businesses at risk, Rubrik provides the power to bounce back fast. More at Rubrik.com.
The Nobel Committee this morning highlighted the work of three economists focused on how institutions affect poverty and wealth within and among countries. Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson of MIT and James A. Robinson at Chicago will share the prize. Institutions that contribute to prosperity are things like the rule of law or freedom of information in the press versus censorship. Here's one of today's laureates, Dr. Acemoglu, on Marketplace back in 2021.
If free flow of information and ideas is curtailed, you're not going to have the very things that have made the United States so successful economically.
Acemoglu speaking with my colleague Kai Rizdahl in 2021. Let's bring in now Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. Chris, institutions can make us richer or poorer. Tell me more.
Well, you had mentioned the rule of law. And do people obey the law? And do people believe the results of the elections? Do you even have an election? And so do people have a voice? Do they have a sense that there is order in the society, order in this political economy, which is an old-fashioned term? And what they've done is they looked at how power is distributed in a society, how resources are allocated in a society. And their bottom line conclusion, David, is that if you have a country with inclusive institutions, that's absolutely key to a well-functioning economy, they're more likely to experience long-term prosperity.
Right. And the contrast would be countries where the population thinks the system is rigged in favor of someone else, countries where, say, the 1% have their hands on the levers of power.
Right. And there's this wonderful term. They're in charge of extractive institutions. I mean, that gives you just a good idea about all the resources that are flowing into their bank accounts, which are probably somewhere outside of the country. And so, you know, they also look into colonization and the long-term impact of colonization. And if you want to read more about their research and their perspective, wonderful book by two of them, Why Nations Fail.
All right, two of today's Nobel laureates are authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Marketplace's Chris Farrell in St. Paul, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Darren Acemoglu, Simon Johnson of MIT, and James Robinson at the University of Chicago share the Nobel Economics Prize today. It's Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It is a minute before 6 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find playlists, podcasts, and much more at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for more from Morning Edition and the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. KAXE's election guide is focused on issues you care about and includes candidates for local government in contested races across northern Minnesota. Visit KAXE.org and click on 2024 Election Guide to learn more about the candidates running to represent you. Our weather today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, winds from the north 5 to 10, gusting higher, mostly clear overnight, lows in the upper 20s.